Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app, and let's get growing. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get enter to get listening to your first audiobook today.
There we go.
Hi, Nina.
Hi there, right? Jackie. Yeah, Nina. Okay.
Yeah. How are you today?
Okay, and how are you?
I'm super good. So it's Friday. I had yesterday off. I went for a big walk and went and got firewood with my husband. That was really easy to split. So that's always
that's always nice,
right?
Yeah.
Some really nice dry larch, both of them. So, and the woods are so pretty, and it's not hunting season yet, so it's nice to be out.
Yeah.
Today we're talking about cottage foods. I was reading through the frequently asked questions and thought, wow, look at all this stuff here. So I think listeners are really going to like this, and especially we're coming up on Christmas. You know, people are going to be wondering about bake sales. And the main point of the cottage cheese law is to inspire businesses, right? And my listeners are very innovative, very entrepreneurial, visionary, so...
It's really an idea to give people an opportunity to start a business without all that initial outlay, you know, especially our bakers.
So. And my husband just happens to be an amazing baker. We keep telling him, you should sell this stuff. He makes cookies, he makes bread, he makes cinnamon rolls, he can jelly this week, although I don't think you can do jellies, but I don't know. We'll find out more. Awesome. Well, I think, you know, it'll be, even if listeners don't live in Montana, it will encourage them to be like, wow, is there a law in my state? Can I check that out? Maybe this isn't as hard of a thing as I thought it would be. Or on the flip side, they may be like, I'm not doing all that. That's crazy. And reality might set in, but no, like you said, I mean, hopefully it'll inspire some people to do something they really want to do or are passionate about. So,
yeah, anyway. And especially I think for our small farmer community, it's really a way that they can build their business, especially during the winter months when maybe they're not as busy with other stuff. So,
excellent. Okay, so I'll just introduce you, and we'll probably just not edit very much of anything yet anyway.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes at the end. So welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. It's Friday morning, October 20th in Montana. The sun is just barely starting to – it's pretty dark here still at my house. And I am super excited because I reached out to a guest I had, I think in 2015 – Ed Evanston, who talked about cottage foods after I was at the Aero Expo, coincidentally, which is taking place this weekend in 2017, and said, you know, I was looking through my data, and being the data junkie that I am, his episode had been listened to a lot of times and was very popular. So I said, hey, do you want to come back on? And he said, well, you should talk to Dr. Nina Heisinger because she's in charge of that now. So here today to talk to us about cottage foods is Dr. Nina Heisinger from the Public Health Department of Public Health and Human Services, the Food and Consumer Safety section, to tell us about cottage foods in Montana and around the United States. So welcome to the show today, Nina.
Thank you. You'll get it right.
So I do always kind of just like to start the show asking about like your very first gardening experience. Like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Like, who were you with? Like, where did you grow up in Montana even? Like, do you remember what was the first thing that you grew up?
I grew up in California. And we did a little bit of gardening at home. My mom used to grow flowers and we used to grow a few things in pots. We didn't do a lot of vegetable gardening. My first real gardening experience was actually when I was a graduate student at UC Davis in California. And I decided that we needed to do something with the strip of dirt in the backyard of the townhouse I was living in. And I planted tomatoes. And Davis is great for growing tomatoes. And I had a huge backyard filled with tomatoes, so many tomatoes that I fed a lot of the neighborhood with tomatoes those couple summers that I grew them there in Davis. And then ever since then, I've done a little bit of gardening. But over the last couple of years, I've been much more into gardening, actually put a bunch of raised beds in our backyard in my children's old play area. So I've been doing much more gardening over the last couple of years and actually got involved with Montana Master Gardeners. Been doing that for the last 2 years, so, and enjoying it, growing lots of stuff. And recently this year I've been really involved with our Helena Community Gardens as well, so I like to garden now.
I love that. I love all of that because I love that you didn't really and now you're really falling in love with it. So we're gonna have to come back and do like just a regular interview one day.
Not just on cottage foods.
Yeah, a regular gardening interview and go through the regular questions. But yeah. Today we are here to talk about cottage foods. And do you just want to tell people like maybe a little bit about your background and how you got involved in cottage foods? And then we'll actually talk about what exactly is a cottage food.
Oh, sure. So I've been working here with the food and consumer safety section for about a year and a half now. And jumped right into cottage foods, mostly because of my background. I have a master's in food science and a PhD in food microbiology. And so I've always been interested in food and the things that can grow in food. I worked on salmonella for several years and then also studied a variety of viruses and such. So my interest in cottage food was kind of like when I got here. I'm the training coordinator, just training people about different topics that we cover. And questions kept coming up about different cottage foods, and everybody would turn to me and say, what do you know about this food? And can you look at this process and see, do we need to worry about this new food that somebody wants to add to their cottage food list? So I kind of jumped in and then took over the program about a year ago in terms of just really providing advice to our local sanitarians that actually review the applications. And we'll kind of go through that process. But just giving advice on what is acceptable as a cottage food and what's not. And basically, a cottage food is going to be a food that's not requiring refrigeration or any sort of time temperature control. So something that you could leave out on your counter for days and not worry about getting sick from. So, and we've got a variety of different products we can talk about that are included in that.
Do you want to go through some of those?
Yeah, I'll give you some of the ideas of what's included and what we're seeing in terms of people providing cottage foods. We have as of last week I looked, we had 153 different registrations. So those are different individuals registering cottage food products, and over 1,000 products are registered. Probably the most popular area are our baked goods, our breads, cakes, pastries, and cookies, as well as pies. So a lot of home bakers out there selling their goods in terms of cottage foods. But it also includes, besides those items, it's going to include things like nuts and nut mixes are allowed, snack mixes, jams and jellies, certain ones that are allowed. There are certain fruits that we allow other jellies because they're not standardized. We don't allow, they require further processing to really make sure that they're safe. And then also we allow like dried spice and tea mixes. So we are seeing some individuals that are making teas and selling those as well. And then we also allow like popcorn balls, cotton candy, fudge, and other candies that require a cook step. So something that's going to be able to be left out on a counter and not require refrigeration. Also, honey is another area that we do have several registered individuals that are processing their honey, adding flavors to it and such, and then selling it. Raw honey, actually, you don't need a cottage food license for to sell. So those are kind of the variety of different things we see, and we do have those listed in our information that we give out, the products that are allowed. And then if you have another product that you are considering, then you need to work with your local sanitarian. Often they work with me in terms of seeing if we can approve that product or not. So, but we're seeing lots of cookies and cakes and baked goods. I wish I could taste all 1,000 products that are on our list.
What about eggs? Is that a popular question?
Eggs are not covered under the cottage food laws. Eggs are actually covered through the Department of Livestock. And there is regulations that allow you to sell eggs at like farmers markets and stuff. But that's all handled through the Department of Livestock and not us. Food's okay, a little bit of a complicated subject because certain items are covered under food and consumer safety, and certain items under the Department of Agriculture, and certain items under the Department of Livestock. So, but for farmers markets, you can actually sell eggs at them, and I'd have to look up the actual rule there in terms of eggs. It's whole shell eggs that are clean, free of cracks, and stored at 45 degrees or less are exempted. So you don't need a cottage food license for those. And those you can sell at like farmers markets or other places.
Now, so, isn't there something like, isn't that part of it is that this foods that you're, if you're selling them at a farmer's market, then you don't have to worry about the cottage food thing, but it's for
that's
places
correct.
Besides the
so,
farmer's market, like
so
bake
cottage
sales?
Food is going to allow you to take those foods that you might want to sell, have been selling at the farmer's market, and sell them from your home or from other venues like craft fairs, community gatherings, things like that. So as long as you're selling it directly to the consumer, that's going to work. You could even meet with them in some place and sell it to them. So it doesn't, they don't necessarily have to come to your home. You could be dropping it off to their home or at some other venue that you wanted to meet people at. Your ability to sell beyond just the farmer's market.
And part of the bonus is that you don't have to have a certified baking kitchen to do this.
No.
Right? Like that's one of the benefits.
That's the best part of it, is that with the cottage food, it's you're getting licensed for your own home kitchen. You're getting registered. It's not really a license. Right. It's just a one-time registration. So this allows you to bake the foods at your home and then take them to these various places to sell or have people come to your home and purchase the foods from you. So it allows you to kind of step into business without making that investment in having to prepare them at a commercial kitchen.
I think people are probably like, wow, I never knew. I always thought, and that maybe that's been holding some people back.
Well, that's what we've found, and we've started to try to do some education at different places. We did a little bit of outreach over the summer at some of the farmers markets, just letting people know that the cottage food law does exist and that it gives them an idea of what they could do with their products if they wanted to go beyond the farmer's market and get registered and be able to sell that elsewhere. And also our sanitarians out locally in the counties are trying to get the word out to people that this is a way that they can go beyond that limited market.
That's affordable, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's only like $40, right, to register?
It's $40 one-time registration fee. And you can register as many products as you want. So some of our home bakeries actually have, I think the longest list is around 100 products that somebody is producing at their home and selling. So, we've got quite a few that are doing cakes and things like that for, you know, friends, neighbors, and then the word gets out and then they are able to register and do that as kind of a business out of their own home. So,
and wedding cakes are popular, right?
Yes, wedding cakes are very popular too. So that's another item that we see on our list. Sometimes there are some limitations on some of the wedding cakes. People want to move into things that require refrigeration, and then they're going to have to move into that another type of licensing.
Like the frostings, right?
Butter cream frostings actually that people use do actually qualify as a cottage food. So it just depends on the formulation. It's just got to be one that does not require refrigeration. So, and there are recipes out there that have enough sugar and not so good things for you in them that they really don't require the refrigeration. So,
okay. Do you want to talk about, like, when is this a new law in Montana, or has this been around?
It is. It went into effect in October 2015. We actually had it went into effect October 1st, and I think the first registration was like October 9th. We approved the first registration. So the people that were involved in getting this law passed were very enthusiastic about getting registered and being able to sell their products that were made at home. There, you know, it had been talked about in the previous legislature, but it didn't really happen. But in 2015, they were able to pass the law. And that's what we see across the United States, is that a lot of these cottage foods have gone into effect in the last 10 years or so. In terms of letting people sell things that are made in a home kitchen, in different venues than just a farmer's market.
Now, what are some things that have really stuck out to you about different states from Montana?
Well, different states from Montana, some of them require actually the kitchens to be inspected. We do not. Which is good, because I just don't think we have the manpower here in terms of that. Actually, we're kind of middle of the road on most of these things. A lot of states do allow individuals to sell them from their home and venues. Some of them are more limited in terms of that they can only sell from their home, or they can only sell at farmers markets. But we allow people to do, you know, sell from their home or other community venues. Another thing, some states do not require any sort of registration, but now quite a few of them do in terms of that. We don't require safety training. About 10 states actually do require individuals to get that food safety training that you would think about for people with restaurants and such. Many states actually have a limit on the amount of sales that you can do. We do not. So they have a dollar limit of $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. It just depends on the state that you're looking at. Some states do allow individuals to sell indirectly, like through another person. Here in Montana, it needs to be a direct sale from the producer to the consumer. So if you're making it, you're selling it to the individual. And so that's one kind of sticky point. Sometimes people find that they want to try to have somebody else sell it. But we want to have that consumer be able to ask the producer questions about that product if they have any questions. And most states, almost all states, require some sort of labeling on the products. And so we're kind of along with most states on that. And that's sometimes a struggle for our producers that are first doing it. But we do have good guidelines on those labels. They're pretty straightforward. And as I tell most of our producers, it's good to have a label on something so that your customer can come back to you and contact you when they want more of that product. Sometimes some people think it's a burden, but it's a way of increasing your business as well in terms of that. States really vary in terms of what they allow and what they don't allow. Almost all the states that have a cottage food law do allow baked goods and candies, but some of them don't allow the jams. Some of them don't allow the fruit butters. We do. We also allow dried fruit. Some states do, some states don't. And then we see probably in terms of products that we don't allow that other states allow, probably the most popular one is vinegars. We don't allow that. And then pickled foods as well. And we don't allow those here in Montana because usually those require more controls in terms of how they're produced to make sure that they're safe and don't lead to food poisoning. So, but yeah, that's kind of the different things that we see across the U.S.
That's what my husband wants to have, is a pickle bucket so the kids can get a pickle.
Yeah, and that's something that then you're going to need a retail license for rather than a cottage food. Just because we have to make sure that there's more safeguards in place in terms of that person knowing how to control the pH of the solution and being able to avoid Clostridium botulinum and other organisms that might be found in some of those foods if they're not processed correctly. So,
okay. Well, I sure wouldn't ever want to do that.
No. So the foods, you know, if you think about the foods that we have on our list, if you think about foods that usually cause foodborne illness, which is what we're concerned about here in food and consumer safety, those foods that I've listed are not usually involved in foodborne outbreaks. Yeah. So we've tried to pick products that we know pretty much that if somebody makes it and leaves it on their counter for the week, it may go bad spoilage wise, but it's not going to go bad because of a foodborne organism growing on it. So that's why like we allow fruit pies, but we don't allow like custard pies because custards need to be refrigerated. Otherwise they can lead to problems. And foodborne organisms can grow on those and then cause problems for individuals if they're not refrigerated. So yeah.
And fruit pies don't? That's interesting.
Most fruits, no, because actually people don't realize it, but fruit tends to have a fairly low pH to it. So it tends to be acidic, and those acidic conditions kill off most of the bacteria that would otherwise be a problem. That's why things like jams and jellies, we have a whole list of fruits that are allowed, but all those fruits have acid in them, and that acid acts as a natural microorganism killer. So it keeps the microorganisms from growing, and usually if the pH is low enough, it actually kills off those organisms. So that's why our jams and jellies can last on our shelves for often a very long time if they're canned correctly. And usually the things that you find growing on jams and jellies will be molds or something like that, but not the bacteria that we worry about making you sick. So the molds can make you sick too, but it takes them a while to grow, and you usually go and see that growth. So
okay. Let's see. We've talked about a lot of these questions just like going
through. We haven't really talked about how somebody goes about getting a cottage food registered.
Okay.
So we have information on our website, which is the Food and Consumer Safety website. It's just fcss.mt.gov. And if you're in another state, usually if you just type in cottage food in your state name, it'll give you a link to the place. But in our state, we have people, the sanitarians, the local health, environmental health people, they will take your registration. So you can print it off of our website, or you can go to your local sanitarian, your environmental health office, and they'll have the registration there as well. And it's a form that you fill out. You fill out some information about where you're located, and then you have to turn in your different items that you want to register. So you're turning in the recipes and the processing for your items. And those recipes are considered trade secrets. So either depending on the office, the sanitarian keeps those either in a confidential file, or they'll destroy them after they review them. It just depends on the sanitarian, how they want to store them or return them to the individual. But they do need to look over the items and how they're produced to make sure that it's going to be a safe item and that there's no questions about it. Most items, it's pretty quick to be able to approve them if they're kind of standard things like strawberry jam or jelly, something like that. If it's something that we haven't heard of before, or maybe a little more complicated baking recipe, then sometimes they ask for help in terms of evaluating those. It just depends on the items. So a lot of, and how many items. So somebody that turns in 100 items, it may take longer to review them than somebody that's just making like 10 different types of cookies. So,
One of the things, it seems like, I can't remember, it's been, you know, so long, if it was like at the conference when Ed was talking, or if it was when we were doing your interview.
Yeah.
I remember one of the big questions that people were concerned about was they didn't want to put grandma's, you know, private recipe on the label or the ingredients. Like, is that, what does the label have to have? Doesn't it have to list the ingredients?
It has to list the ingredients. The reason for that is that there's a lot of people out there with different allergies or intolerances for different items. And so like any item that you buy at the store, it lists what's in that item. So people need to know what's in that item. And it's not as though you are revealing, you know, how you make it or how much of anything goes in there. And there are some ways to be able to just say like spices and flavorings if they're in a small enough amount. You know,
and the ingredients go by
natural
in order of like the weight
in order
in the recipe or
the
weight. Order of,
yeah.
Right.
The weight that they're in the recipe. So, and there's a variety of different tools online that you can just type in 1 cup of flour and it'll give you the weight of it. So,
okay, I have to recommend a resource for listeners. So there's an app called MyFitnessPal, and you can go on your desktop on your regular computer or download the app on your phone. And it's free. There is a premium version, but I get by with the free version. And I have entered plenty of Mike's recipes in there, and it will, like, tell you everything you need to know about it, like the nutrition, the, you know, amount of sugar, the amount of protein. It will, like, give you all those nutrition facts.
Oh,
and you just
okay.
say, like, how many, you know, it's going to make 25 servings, and I can enter in. Because I want to know, because he has cookies, and, like, his muffins are, like, 330 calories each, and his muffins are, like, his cookies are, like, 100 and something calories each. And so
yeah.
I try to, like, keep track of, like, what I'm eating and how much exercise I get every day on MyFitnessPal. But just as a side bonus, it will tell you all those nutrition facts about your recipes.
Yeah.
The only thing it drives
me
crazy
is
you can't ever edit them. So if you put the wrong ingredient, you have to start from the beginning.
Yeah. And on your label, you actually don't have to include any nutritional information. All you have to include on the label is the name of the product, the ingredients, who's making it, so like your name and contact information, your address, and then how much is in the package. So just those four items need to be on there. The name, the ingredients, who's producing it, and then how much is in the package. So
that was another question. Like, if Mike bakes it, I can't sell it at the farmer's market, right? Unless I help him bake it or something. Was that what it was? Or like, because he tends to be the baker and I tend to be the person who's in the public. But we can't do that, right?
But if you registered the two of you as the cottage food operator, then you could.
Okay.
So if it's like a joint, you know, a husband-wife or partner relationship like that, where you're both living in the same household, we do require that the stuff be made at the registered person's or person's home. So it's not like you could go over to your buddy's house and make the food there. It would have to be your own place that you're making it at. But you can have more than one owner of the operation. So many of our operations are joint operations between, like, husband and wife or mother and daughter.
That's what I was thinking.
Actually, with our bakeries, you know. So, yeah. And then, yeah. But one of you needs to live at the place that's a home kitchen. So, yeah. But, yes, so you and Mike could get registered, give your operation a lovely name, and then you would both be just listed as the owner, and then you could help sell the stuff. Because you would be aware of what's in the foods and how it's prepared would be the main thing on that. So.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the frequently asked questions. One of the things I was surprised about, so pet treats, they don't fall under it. So where do they come under? And is that the Department of Livestock again?
Yeah.
Wait, they're not livestock though. I don't know. Is it?
We don't do anything with animal food. I'm trying to think if it's Department of Livestock. I think it might be. Or Department of Ag. I would have to get back to you on, have to look up that information, because I'm not quite sure on that one, who's regulates.
That's okay.
Pet treats, but it's not us.
Okay, so let's see. We talked about the registration. How about how to register a business name? They go through the Secretary of State?
Oh, yeah. If you want to actually register the business name, that's separate, and that's through the Secretary of State. There's an application you go through to register an actual business name. So now some of our cottage food people just use their own name as their business. So then they're not really, they don't need to register as a separate business name. But if you want a name that's exclusively yours, then you're going to need to register with the Secretary of State as a business.
Okay, and I'm going to give listeners another resource out there. So a lot of listeners know I listen to John Lee Dumas, and his show is called Entrepreneur on Fire. And every month they put out an actual income report where they, you know, go through their income. But on that episode each month, they have their CPA come on, and he gives a tip. And he actually calls his business now CPA on Fire. And if you go to his website, he's got a great free resource where you can decide. So he says the biggest question he got is, should I be an LLC? Should I be a sole proprietorship? Like, whatever. So if you're going to register your name and you're not sure, check out his website. It's CPA on Fire. His name, I think, is Josh, I want to say Waverly or something. He's super accessible. I emailed him. He emailed me right back. He's always good with taking questions. Of course, during text time, it's harder. But, you know, he's looking for information, what people want to know. So just if you're wondering about, if you're thinking of starting a business of any kind, he's a great resource. And their income report is fascinating. Let's see. Our cottage food, we talked about inspections. We talked about selling at the grocery store.
Yeah,
did,
and
did we talk
don't,
about selling
we don't,
online
We
at
didn't
all?
Actually talk about inspections. We do not go out and inspect unless there is some sort of foodborne illness tied back to food that an individual produces. But otherwise, we don't go out and inspect your home kitchen.
And I think what Ed and I talked about that is that even if something like that happens, don't panic, because even if they come and find something wrong, they're just going to tell you what to do to fix it. Right?
Yeah.
You're not going to get like a fine. You're not going to get
there's not a fine or anything like that. We're just going to come and see if there's some way to prevent this from happening in the future. And sometimes it's not even your fault.
I have, all right, two things that I don't want to forget about, because one thing it seems like Ed and I talked about is like some kind of, I don't know if it's an old wives tale or something about like the contamination comes for baked goods when you're cracking the eggs and if the shell touches the egg white or something. And then the other thing, well, let's go with that question first. Is that something we have to worry about, or is that an old wives tale, or?
Well, the material can become contaminated, but if you then cook the product, you're going to kill off any bacteria that are there. But with eggs, what the recommendation is once you break open those eggs, that you need to go and wash your hands. Because if there was salmonella on the outside of those eggs and you start handling a bunch of other things, you could introduce it into other places. So it just depends, you know, if it's going into something that's baked, and that's what we're talking about with anything that's got raw, you know, eggs added to it, it's going to have to be baked.
Okay. My other question was about sampling at the farmer's market, and this is not covered. You do have to take some kind of class if you want to, like, perhaps, because, like, Joyce Pinson came on my show, this woman in Kentucky, and she said the best way to sell zucchinis is to have people taste the zucchini right there, show them how easy it is to cook it, and let them sample your products. But there was, like, special, and that's not covered under cottage foods, right?
That's
completely different.
Okay. Here's what it says, though, for that question. If you are a licensed manufacturer, a cottage food operation, or a farmer's market vendor, and the samples are exempt from licensure or non-potentially hazardous, then no retail food license is required to give samples at a farmer's market. So you can give samples at a farmer's market as long as it's not a potentially hazardous food. So.
But vegetables don't come under that.
Vegetables,
right?
vegetables
are
separate.
Potentially hazardous food, right?
Vegetables are potentially hazardous. So, I'm going to take just a brief break here and pull something up. So hold on just a second.
Yeah.
Because I've got to pull up. Okay. So for vegetables, it's a little bit different in terms of that, because the vegetables you're usually selling at the farmer's market haven't been washed. And so you're going to want to wash those before somebody tries to consume them. And we don't regulate the vegetables. That's regulated through the Department of Agriculture again. And I don't see anything in terms of our farmer's market information addressing samples of vegetables. So you'd have to work with your local farmer's market manager and ask them what their rules are in terms of that. So, but most vegetables that come to the market, that all they've gotten is like a quick field wash, and not like a thorough washing to remove, you know, bacteria and other things from it. So that's why you want to wash your vegetables before you eat them. Yeah, actually, if somebody starts doing what we call more intensive processing, like if somebody is, you know, taking the lettuce and triple washing it and cutting it up and putting it into bags and such, then it's actually considered a value-added product, and they have to get licensing for that to make sure that the water that they're using to wash the vegetables is okay and such. So it gets a little more complicated when you have further handling of the foods.
Okay. What about selling online? We didn't talk about that. If they want to sell it like on Facebook or Instagram,
it is
Craigslist.
It is fine to advertise it on those places, but they cannot put the product in the mail and send it off to someone. It has to be a face-to-face sale. So they could set up a meeting on Facebook. They can tell everybody that they're going to be at such and such a place at such and such a time. But they actually have to have a face-to-face transaction with the buyer of their product. So they can't put it in a box and send it through the mail to an individual. That's regulated under other laws, and then they're going to need an actual food license at that point. And most of our cottage food people are actually not interested in making stuff that they're, you know, mailing to other individuals. They're making stuff that they want to get to the person in a fairly timely manner. But many of them do advertise online to let people know where they're going to be and when. Or just to connect with people too. Say, hey, I've got all these great baked goods. You know, give me a call, connect with me, and I can make the cake that you want or whatever. You know, the 5 dozen cookies that you need for your party.
Cool.
And we actually encourage people, you know, it's good to get the word out. You know, they can actually let people know that they have a cottage food registration. Some of our individuals actually put their cottage food registration up online, and that's fine too, so that people can see that they are registered. So, you know, they'll have a Facebook page and they'll have their registration right up on their Facebook page. So,
excellent. What about gluten-free products?
Gluten-free products are allowed. There is some information in the materials that we provide. In terms of our rules, you know, we can't say whether or not it's gluten-free. They would have to take precautions to avoid contaminating their products with gluten. So they're going to need to separate those products that have gluten from those products that do not. So some of our operators do produce items that are gluten-free, and they keep that production separate from any items where that might contain gluten. So they produce it in a different part of their kitchen where there are no flour products, and they keep all those items, you know, in containers where they're separated from items that might expose them to gluten. So, but we do have operators that are registered that have gluten-free products. So,
yeah, because probably, and we actually chances are they have in the somebody who's allergic to gluten in their house, so they probably might have just a gluten-free house.
Yeah, already. And we have, they have. And that's actually what we see is often there somebody who has issues in their own family with gluten. And so they've Hello.
Hi. Sometimes it just drops the call. You were talking about someone in their own family having...
Having gluten issues. And so they have a gluten-free kitchen. And they start baking items that are gluten-free and sharing them with friends and families. And then suddenly they have a group of people that are interested in their products. And so then they move on to marketing those products through a cottage food license. So... we do have several items that are registered that are gluten-free items. I can even tell you some of them. Gluten-free zucchini bread, gluten-free strawberry banana bread, gluten-free sandwich bread, gluten-free banana bread, gluten-free vegan rolls, gluten-free pumpkin banana bread. So, yeah, we do have several people that have different products that are gluten-free that they're providing to their customers. There are some, you know, federal regulations in terms of claiming gluten-free, and we can always direct those to people to that information if they have any questions.
Okay. I don't know. There's something on here about laboratory testing.
Usually you don't need laboratory testing if you're using a standardized recipe. That usually only comes in when somebody wants to do a product that's not on our approved list. So they're proposing maybe a jam or jelly that is not from one of the fruits that we currently allow, or a combination. And if you look at our cottage food approved list, you know, it's got a whole list of fruits that are allowed, but sometimes people propose something that's not on that list. So that we may ask them to get that item tested for pH and
like
sugar
pumpkin,
content.
Right, is one of those?
Yeah, pumpkin is one of those that is not on the list, but sometimes people have made like an apple pumpkin product and gotten it tested to make sure that that pH is below 4.6, which is kind of the cutoff there in terms of food safety. Above 4.6, several organisms that cause foodborne illness can grow. But below 4.6, those organisms don't usually grow in products. So that's why we have that regulation there. So usually when we're talking about testing, it is on a product that isn't just one of our standard products that we see, but somebody's proposing it and really wants to do it. So then we'll have them send it off to a food processing lab, and that can cost anywhere from $25 to $75, depending on how much testing they do.
Now, when you say send it off, they actually send off the finished product, like the actual bread,
yeah.
Or they send the pumpkin? It's the final
product. They actually send the final product along with the recipe to the lab, and the lab actually takes samples of that food and tests it for pH, for something called water activity, which is how much water is available to microorganisms to grow in that product. And so they'll test for those items to see, is that food going to be a concern, or is it fine and we don't need to be worried about, you know, foodborne illness possibly resulting from that food.
Okay.
We're just trying to protect people from, you know, our concern is having a product out there that can make someone sick. So we err on the side of caution to make sure that, you know, that we don't end up with a large foodborne outbreak from a product. So a lot of times, if you think about it, you know, when you're making things just for your friends and family, that's not a very large group of people. But once somebody starts selling something, maybe at, you know, to a larger population of individuals, then we got to start worrying about, well, could this make people sick? And do we need to be worried about, you know, more vulnerable populations getting this product and becoming ill? So that's why we've picked the products that we have in terms of this list of approved products. Because we pretty much know that if somebody bakes a loaf of just, you know, whole wheat bread or zucchini bread, it's not going to make somebody sick.
I think that's inspiring.
Yeah.
I think people are going to be excited to hear this. They're going to be like, wow, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So hopefully people's minds are churning and they're like, especially
those
like
products, those value added products that are, you know, small time producers could be making at home and getting out there and selling. And I mean, some of our places do very well in terms of, you know, the number of products they're selling as well as, just being able to carry out a fairly large business out of their home. So on their own time, you know, and they can do something that they love and make some money off of it.
That other people appreciate. I mean, I know people love Mike's breads and his cookies and are always excited to get them, and they're healthy for it. You know, he always uses, you know, really good flour and sugar, and he always puts walnuts in them, which it's good to get those walnuts in your system. You know, your CoQ10 and stuff that's in walnuts. And just, I feel like his cookies often are more healthy than like a Clif Bar or something that I'm going to buy at the grocery store. So people
and
appreciate him. The thing that I am always like, you'd have to sell it for like $10, it seems like, because the cost of the ingredients are so expensive.
Well, that's what you need to sit down and figure out is, you know, what does it cost you per cookie? So as you take all those ingredients and write out your recipe, hopefully you can take, now you know the weight, you know the weight of the whole container that you bought, and you can figure out, well, how much of that container and how much did I pay for it? So how much is each cookie costing me? And figure out a fair price once you've looked at that cost and then figuring in the time and everything. So, but, you know, we find that often you can produce a loaf of bread at home for under a dollar and be able to sell it for $4 or $5, especially if it's good bread. People are willing to pay that. And you can see that even with cookies, people are often willing, you know, if you talk about the cookie costing you 25 cents to make, but you're able to sell it for $1.50, then it starts to make sense, especially if you can sell, you know, 10 of those or 20 of those or 50 of those, you're starting to make some money as you start to add together the costs and then the expense. And that you're able to market.
Hey, Green Future Growers. Don't forget to get your copy of the 2018 Organic Gardener Podcast Garden Journal and Data Keeper, available now at Amazon.com for $16.95. It's a place to keep track of your organic gardening journey, where you can record temperature, weather, recipes, produce that you grew, produce that you bought, and just all your successes and failures and challenges and dreams for the future, all your garden goals. Keep them track of them in one place. 225 pages that will go through each week of the year for the 2018 year. And just there's blank pages in there where you can sketch or write or do anything that will help you record your journey. So don't forget to get a copy of the 2018 Garden Journal and Data Keeper, available at Amazon. You can go to the organicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 for the link. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener Podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.